welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The flu season is upon us, and we can expect it to peak in February and maybe end in May. It's hard to tell how widespread the flu season will be, but either way, thousands of people will be infected, and up to 50,000 may die, maybe even more. The flu is serious business. Joining us today to talk about influenza is Dr. Jordan Goldman. He's Vice President and System Epidemiologist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
And I should mention, by way of disclosure, that UPMC Pinnacle is a financial supporter of Smart Talk. If you have a question or a comment about the flu, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number is 1-800-729-7532. The Centers for Disease Control say that every flu season is unpredictable, but that hasn't stopped other organizations or other people from predicting a really bad flu season or a mild flu season. Where do you come down on this?
I come down on it's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. We know,
Yes, Yogi.
We know, however, that we are going to have a flu season this year. We know that even in a mild flu season, roughly 10,000 people will die. Roughly 250,000 will be hospitalized. Now, last year, when we had a very severe flu season, we actually had roughly 80,000 die, roughly 500,000 hospitalized. So we don't know how severe this season will be, but we do know it will occur. And in a very mild season, we have 10,000 deaths, 250,000 hospitalizations. So we know it will occur. We know that we should do what we need to do to protect ourselves. We know that basically we all should get flu shots. Last year, they got a lot of publicity because the flu shot was about 40% effective. On the other hand, it probably prevented about 5 million illnesses, probably prevented about 500,000 hospitalizations, and it's hard to tell how many deaths it prevented. What we do know is we will have a flu season. What we do know is you can protect yourselves. And when they say the flu shot isn't effective, it means that it decreases your chances of needing medical attention, getting the flu. On the other hand, people who get the flu shot and get the flu anyway are much less likely to end up hospitalized, much less likely to die. It is very hard to predict how severe the season will be.
Just to square the numbers, because I said in the introduction that came from the CDC, by the way, 12,000 to 49,000, and those are deaths. Those numbers come from like the last decade, but as you mentioned, 80,000 last year in 2017, 2018. Why so high?
For a couple of reasons. First of all, this type of flu that was circulating was the H3N2 strain. H3N2 typically produces roughly twice as many deaths than the typical season for all other types of the flu. So if we have an H3N2 season, the season where that is the most common strain, people are sicker, they end up hospitalized more, and on average twice as many people die than in a typical flu season. In addition, this flu season really started in early November.
You mean last year?
Last year. Okay. Last year. Started in early November and lasted until roughly early March. So not only was it severe, but it is opposed to what it usually does, which is peaks and then peaks quickly and fades out. This one started early, peaked early, but really stayed at high levels throughout the season. For whatever reason, the strain of flu that was circulating was not only the more powerful H3N2 strain, but was more severe than a typical H3N2.
What you just talked about, the strains of flu, the different strains of flu, is one of the reasons that it makes it difficult to predict what vaccine to produce. How is that decided? I mean, obviously, there are a lot of people like you, a lot of scientists out there who are trying to figure out, okay, what's the strain that's going to be needed? What's the vaccine that's going to be needed? How do you predict that?
Well, part of what you predict is you know what's been circulating. And also, we have the advantage of that right now it's the flu season in the southern hemisphere is ending. So it's based upon the type of flu that's circulating in the southern hemisphere with the idea that it's going to come to our portion of the world during our flu season. There is also always a little bit of what's called antigenic drift. The reason that you're not immune to the flu once you get it is the flu virus changes a little bit from year to year. So they both have to predict the type of virus, they both have to, and then they have to sort of predict the antigens in the virus. In fact, the flu vaccine is usually pretty good, even though there was the publicity last year about how ineffective it was. It probably worked about 40% effective. Part of the issue is that the H3N2 strain, the more powerful strain, typically is less effective. The flu vaccine is less effective against it than it is against other types of influenza. Influenza B, the H1N1 strain, the swine flu strain. And in fact, the vaccine last year was about 60% effective against H1N1, about 50% effective against influenza B. Unfortunately, the type of strain that was most widely circulating was the type of strain the vaccine is typically less effective with. Now, very hard to predict what strain is going to predominate next season in the southern hemisphere. It's been the H1N1 strain. Now, the H1N1 strain typically produces a much milder season, many fewer deaths. The reason for that is it produces many fewer deaths among older people, the people who are typically most affected by the flu. On the other hand, it actually, for reasons we really don't understand, often causes much more severe illness in young people, people who typically don't get infected.
What do you call young?
That number keeps going up, but below the age of 50.
Okay.
And so when we have a season like the one we have fewer hospitalizations, fewer deaths, but it often makes young, healthy people more sick. The good news is that both H3N2 and H1N1 are in the current vaccine. H1N1, the vaccine, is more effective. So I'm really advocating that especially young people, people who don't think they're at risk, get the vaccine this year, because if it is the type of strain that's circulating in the southern hemisphere, young people are at the highest risk, the people who don't think they're going to get sick from the flu. And we actually saw someone who was relatively young got the flu outside of this area and got incredibly sick and I believe died already this season. So I really can't emphasize the importance of getting your vaccine, because we know that even in a mild season, 10,000 people die. We know that if you get your vaccine, you're less likely to get sick, but you're much less likely to get severely sick.
When you said young people, my first thought was, when we were talking about numbers, is that last year we had an unusually high number of deaths, pediatric deaths of the flu.
Yeah.
Do we know why?
We think it was simply because it was that the flu season was more severe. And we know that children below the age of 6 years of age in any season are at higher risk. So one of the age groups that they strongly recommend vaccination for is children below the age of six, because in any flu season, they have a higher risk of hospitalization, they have a higher risk of death. There were more pediatric deaths during this flu season because there were just simply more deaths overall. Now, the last time we had a H1N1, the swine flu, the one that's circulating in the southern hemisphere, the risk of death was 5 to 10 times the usual risk of death in young people, people less than the age of 50, but then much lower among people greater than 50 and greater than 65. So this type of season actually, again, often affects people who are young and healthy.
couple of things here. The weather this year has been very unusual. Now, we want to talk about this myth right off the bat, that the cold does not provide, make someone get a cold or the flu. It's just that people are more together, they're indoors, doorknobs, it spreads a little bit more. But because the weather has been so unusually warm into October, does that mean, or do we even know, that the flu season will start a little bit later or there will be fewer cases of flu?
We don't know. So you would think that it might start later. First of all, we don't know what the weather's going to be. And second of all, we typically see it as it gets a little colder. People are more in closer proximity. But I don't believe there is a good correlation between the severity of the season and the coldness, how warm or cold the winter or the fall are.
Has more to do with the strain.
Has more to do with the strain, and obviously, you do not get the flu from being out in the cold. One of my favorite studies is I believe it was medical students. They took a bunch of them out and put them in 50-degree weather and kept them on a football field for a couple hours. They let the other group sit inside where it was warm, and there was no effect whatsoever of which group got the colds, flus, more. So despite what your mom told you, you can't get the flu from not wearing your coat.
And I wish I could recall this, which president it was who gave his inauguration speech without a coat in 20-degree weather and died of pneumonia a month later. Well, that's a story that would seem to say that guy wasn't very bright. First of all, he may not have been wearing no coat in 20-degree weather, but that his pneumonia came about because he was out in cold weather, and that's not the case.
That is not the case.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. John Goldman. He's the Vice President and System Epidemiologist with UPMC Pinnacle. We're talking about the flu season, which typically starts in October. Dr. Goldman already mentioned that he's already seen one flu death so far of someone who did travel. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, you already have a question about the immunization, and I hear this from a lot of people. How long does the immunization last from the time that you receive the shot?
It should last until the end of the season. There's always a controversy about when you should get your flu shot. There's some people who advocate waiting till the start of October, later in October. I got mine in early September. I got it as soon as it's available. First of all, the most important thing is to get your shot. If it's offered to you, just get it. The CDC does recommend that you get your flu shot by late October. So they recommend that you get it as soon as it's available. We've started giving flu shots as early as late August. It is recommended that you get them by the end of October. On the other hand, flu season has not really started yet, especially in this area. Last year's flu season lasted until late March, and we kept giving flu shots. We keep giving flu shots until the season ends. So if you have someone who has not received the shot, we often give it January, February, even into March, provided there's activity.
Does it make sense, maybe if there is a different strain, or that you did get it very early on and the flu season is going longer, to get more than one?
I usually don't recommend that. There's possibility that you would boost your immunity. On the other hand, the strains are going to be the same. And two, you have a slightly higher risk of reactions when you get two.
By the way, our listeners always keep us on our toes. Barbara from Quarryville wanted to call in and tell us that president was William D. Harrison, who unfortunately decided to go out in the cold weather without a coat on. Let's take a phone call from, I think it's Beatty from Fayetteville. Beatty, you're on the air. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes, sir. It's Dee Dee. Thank you.
Oh, Dee Dee. Okay. They put a B in front of your name. That went in here. But so, Dee Dee, what's your question or comment?
So, thank you for taking my call. My question is, out of the recorded deaths caused by flu in a particular season, do you have any numbers or data on how many of those people had indeed received the flu vaccine? for that season?
We don't have any numbers on the percentage that precede the flu vaccine. The CDC guesses that that prevents death. They do not give numbers on how many deaths that they think will have been prevented. Again, it is much less likely that you are going to get severely ill if you get the flu shot. Quite honestly, when I see someone who's very sick with the flu, I don't quite have the heart to ask them whether or not they had the flu shot while they're that ill.
But just to clarify, there are people who actually will die even if they've gotten a flu shot?
Absolutely. The flu shot is not 100. You can still get sick. You can still get very sick. Your chances of getting sick are less, and your chances of getting very sick are much less.
Dee Dee, anything else?
No, sir. Thank you. That makes sense to me. I was just curious if, you know, if they had that data, people could say, okay, out of, you know, 100 people that died, 80 of them were vaccinated, which would make a stronger case for vaccination maybe for some of those people who don't find it, you know, necessary or on the fence.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your call. You know, she does bring up a point that eventually was going to get to anyway. Let's face it, nowadays there are a lot of people who don't want to get shots.
Absolutely.
Not just because they're afraid of shots, the pain of a shot, or have a phobia about it, but because of the side effects that come along with it, or think that a flu shot or other shots can cause other conditions with their bodies or their children's bodies. What do you say to those people?
I'd say it is a fear that is not supported by the data. So, for example, they have done studies where they have given people flu shots and they've given them shots of salt water. The only side effect that is more common when you get a flu shot is pain at the injection site. There's not an increase in fevers. There's not an increase in reactions. It's a very benign shot. In addition, there are some that people vary in the order of one or two out of a million can get what's called Guillain-Barré. That's where you have an attack of the nervous system, typically can have what's called an ascending paralysis. You get weak from the bottom up, from the legs up, and that can be very serious. Not everyone recovers, and some people do, in fact, die. However, even though there is a risk from the flu shot, there is a much higher risk from the flu of getting Guillain-Barré, and your risk of getting Guillain-Barré because you weren't vaccinated and got the flu is much higher. So there is a risk from the shot, but you actually have a much higher risk from the flu, and not getting the shot puts you at higher risk because you're more likely to get the flu.
Have you ever seen that?
I've never seen Guillain-Barré from the flu shot. I've seen Guillain-Barré from other illnesses, but I've never seen it from the flu shot.
We have a question here from Bill. Says, I'm 36. I got a pretty nasty cold starting over a week ago. I'm still having lingering effects. Should I be totally recovered before I get a shot?
You know, they recommend that you are recovered before the shot. I would just say that if you are, you should not have a fever. I would wait until you are, for the most part, recovered. I certainly wouldn't do it while you're actively sick, while you actively have fevers.
He said he had a cold. What's the difference between a cold and the flu?
So the cold is due to a different virus or different set of viruses. The flu is due to influenza. In general, influenza makes you more sick. It gives you higher temperatures, more muscle aches, more body aches, although there's a great variation in it. The colds are due to a set of viruses called rhinoviruses. The flu vaccine does not give you any protection against these viruses. One of the reason, and the colds tend to be less severe. They cause runny nose. They cause some low-grade fevers. They just simply don't make you as sick. They just don't make it as likely that you will be hospitalized. Almost no one ever dies from them. One of the reasons people often say, I got my flu shot, but I got the flu anyway, is during respiratory season, during the time that the flu is common, there are a whole lot of other stuff going around, particularly colds, particularly rhinoviruses, and the flu shot doesn't protect against them. So often what happens is people say, I got the flu despite getting the flu shot, when what they really mean is I got a cold despite getting the flu shot. And the flu shot doesn't protect against cold.
All right, so how do people know the difference between a cold and flu?
Flu's, one, you don't always. You can have a mild version of the flu, or you can have a severe cold. But in general, with the flu, you get higher fevers. You get a lot more runny nose. You get a lot of muscle aches. Most people who really have the flu feel sick. Most people who just have a cold feel relatively well.
When you get the flu or suspect you have the flu, should you always seek medical attention? Or I've heard many people say, oh, I have a touch of the flu.
Okay, so for most people who have the flu but are not in a high-risk group, they are not below the age of 6, they're not above the age of 55 or 65, and they don't have anything wrong with their heart or their lungs, best treatment of the flu is rest, hydration, and Tylenol. If you are someone who is at higher risk, it's recommended that you be treated with one of Tamiflu, one of the anti-flu drugs. Healthy people will have if you give them Tamiflu, will have a roughly 24 hours less of symptoms, so you have to start it very early. But if you are one of those people that has diabetes, has problems with your kidneys, has problems with your lungs, has problems with your liver, then you should at least call your doctor, because many times during flu season, we don't want people coming to the ER. We don't want them coming to the office and infecting other people in the waiting room. Calling the doctor and either having them arrange to see you or have them arrange to call in a medication. We strongly discourage people who just have the flu and aren't particularly sick from, for example, going to the ER. Now, if you are very sick, and very sick is you're having trouble breathing, you're dizzy when you're standing up, you're having chest pain, or if you have a little bit of the flu, you're getting better and then suddenly you get worse, then you should be seen. Either if the flu is causing you to interfering with your breathing, interfering with your ability to take in food and water, or the people who get better then get sick sometimes get the flu but then get a pneumonia on top of the flu, get a bacterial infection on top of the flu. Those are the people who should seek medical attention. When I've had the flu, I've stayed home, drank a lot of water, kept myself hydrated, and made my wife miserable.
How often do doctors get the flu?
You know, we get the flu just like everybody else, partially because when it circulates, there's no protection against it. That's one of the reasons now that flu vaccination is essentially mandatory for most healthcare workers. Not only will it prevent us from getting sick, but it prevents us from giving it to our patients.
So even with gloves, with the protections that you take, maybe even masks, you can get it.
Absolutely. Now, one of the issues is that most people are infectious with the flu before they become symptomatic with the flu. For roughly 24 hours before you feel sick, you can give the flu to other people. So that's one of the reasons there's such an emphasis on both vaccinating healthcare workers, but also vaccinating family members, contacts, caretakers of people who take care of high-risk patients. Someone, an elderly patient, an elderly parent, an elderly grandparent, a young child. Because if you get the flu and you're young and healthy, it's probably not going to cause you much of a problem. If you are someone who has contact with an elderly parent, an elderly grandparent, a young kid, it's possible you will make them sick and something bad will happen. Mm-hmm. In addition, because you are going to be infectious before you know you have the flu, there's no way that you can be so careful that you can prevent possibly transmitting it to them.
You know, one of the things I've always wondered about is, I mean, obviously when we're talking about 10 to 50,000 in a typical year dying of the mm-hmm. flu, last year 80,000, maybe it's because people tend to confuse the colds with mm-hmm. flu, but many people don't think of the flu as that serious. What actually causes death when someone has influenza?
So a couple of things. What often causes death when someone has his influenza is either in young people, the disease is severe enough that it makes them very sick. Or a lot of times it decompensates one of their chronic medical conditions. So one of the reasons people who are older, people who have problems with their heart, problems with their lungs, die from the flu isn't that they don't die directly of the flu, but the flu causes them to go into heart failure. The flu causes their asthma or their emphysema to get much worse. The flu initially infects them, but then they get a pneumonia on top of it, which makes them very sick. So it's often that people die of the complications of the flu rather than directly from the flu.
Mm-hmm. But it's still, for statistics' sake, it is attributed to the flu.
But it's for statistics' sake. And also, what the CDC does is it also just simply monitors the death rates. Because when we have a flu outbreak, the way they know they have an outbreak is they're seeing more deaths than usual.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Goldman, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. The flu shot is probably one of the most important things we can talk about today. I know that we have some people out there listening who are saying that, okay, I want to get a flu shot, but I'm concerned about being able to afford it. What about that?
Usually the Department of Health will have clinics where you can get it. Almost all insurance companies pay for the flu shot because they know it's going to save them money. It's going to prevent you getting sick. And many workplaces offer the flu shot because they know that it's cost effective to offer the flu shot because it's going to prevent the employees from missing work from getting sick.
Mm-hmm. Final question, what advice would you give to everyone?
The advice that I would most give to everyone is, one, get your flu shot. Two, be aware during flu season of the possibility of the flu. Don't come to the ER or the emergency room if you get the flu. If you're beginning to get very sick, then call your doctor.
Dr. John Goldman is Vice President and System Epidemiologist with UPMC Pinnacle. Dr. Goldman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. For more on the flu, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org. It's a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. The State Museum of Pennsylvania is celebrating 50 years of the Mammal Hall, one of its most popular exhibits. A three-year restoration project costing $680,000 was recently completed and the hall rededicated. It is getting a lot of attention. The special collection of dioramas depict common and rare species of Pennsylvania wildlife in their natural habitats. Joining us to tell us more about it today is Beth Hager. She is the director of the State Museum of Pennsylvania. Beth, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having us.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Beth, when I say that this is getting a lot of attention, I see that you brought... Okay, now, I know we have pictures that we're going to put on our website, witf.org. You have stuffed animals here. What do you have?
Scott, first of all, congratulations on 10 years of
Smart
Talk.
Thank you very much.
I saw you at the event here at WITF the other night, and you asked me to bring a mammal with me.
That's right.
You know, and I thought, well, as a professional museum, we can't just grab things off the floor or storage and bring them in.
Why
it's not easy, especially when it's raining like cats and dogs outside. So I thought, let me bring some other stuffed animals from our museum store. And just, these are all a bear, fox, elk, bison and wolf. Those are several of the animals in our dioramas.
I guess it is an elk. I couldn't see the elk's antlers
elk right
from here. But these, if you do see the photograph on our website, WITF.org, I think the mammal exhibit, the exhibits are a little bit bigger than that.
So, yes, this is a miniature version.
These are cuter, by the way. But why do you think it is that this has gotten so much attention from the public? And I know you've publicized it a lot, the mammal exhibit and the restoration has gotten so much attention.
Well, the Mammal Hall exhibit we've seen over the years is an incredible touchstone for Pennsylvanians. They remember that coming, you know, it's 50 years old. Many people remember growing up, seeing the animals. So many people, if they hear I work at the State Museum, do you still have the animals? Pennsylvanians love their nature, so they love being able to see things that they can't really see easily out in the wilds. But I think also because it was so well done by masters of the art 50 years ago. These are excellent dioramas. They stand up to any dioramas in the world. Now, I'm not completely just bragging. They are very good. And they were very much worth keeping because we knew how much people love them. And we wanted to restore them to keep them going for years to come.
When you said that people remember it even from when they were younger, mm-hmm. the Mammal Hall, that exhibit is actually one of the first that was in the State Museum,
exactly.
Right?
The museum opened its doors officially in 1965, and they started working on that hall as the first permanent exhibit. There were other temporary exhibits, but the architects actually designed the diorama windows when they were designing the building in the early 60s, so it was always intended to bring in some of the collections they'd had earlier when the museum was in the Ryan Building next door to the Capitol. Bring it into the new mid-century modern building, and then also get other specimens from the Game Commission and some other sources to make these dioramas as of an important teaching tool. And, you know, we have 40,000 kids coming every year to the museum, and that's been going on for 50 years. So, again, there's so many people out there, like alumni of the museum, and they remember these and other exhibits. But, again, they're so well done. They're just a great memory for people.
All right. As you said, with the stuffed animals you have here, the miniature versions, black bear, fox, elk, bison, and wolf. But what are those are obviously some of the animals mm-hmm. that are native to Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
The bison and the wolf were extirpated.
They're no longer in Pennsylvania,
but there are about
three dioramas that show some former things. I want to emphasize something that we're now emphasizing through new interpretive signage, which we've never had in there before. Actually, signage you can read because it's illuminated. These scenes are real places in Pennsylvania. They're not just magic, you know, imagined backdrops or whatever. The artists and curators went out in 1965 and chose very specific sites in Pennsylvania. I've been to a couple of them with other staff, and it is remarkable how they recreated the scene. When you see the real place, it's like, that's it, that's our diorama. Many of them are on private land, but one of the ones that I found breathtaking was at Colton Point State Park up in the Pennsylvania Grand Canyon area, mm-hmm. right next
Tioga
to Wellsboro.
County, yeah.
The original designers chose a scenic outlook to be the cliff that the wolves are on. And you can go there and stand right there and pretend you're in our diorama. But it's really fascinating that these are real places, real, you know, specific times of day, specific seasons. And part of our restoration was to replace all of the old lighting and get, you know, today they, so much can be done technically with wonderful new lighting and adjustments to really recreate a very realistic scene. The paintings are not, again, not just wallpaper. They are real scenes. There's an art to diorama painting, and they are integral into creating that tie-in. That, again, why ours are so well done, because there's a very realistic tie-in between the paintings and the foreground material. It creates an illusion of depth. So,
why is it important, though? Accuracy and realism, why mm-hmm. is that important? I mean, as you said, there are many museums, many exhibits you can see anywhere where mm-hmm. it's just a very generic mm-hmm. blue sky, clouds, mm-hmm. woodlands. Why is it important?
Well, again, I think that's why people, it's memorable, and why they're liked, because when they're accurate and they create an illusion, they're believable, and they're stunning. You know, I think that's part of the draw, because people detect the authenticity.
They don't want
of
to see
them.
Something fake.
No. Mm-mm. So, of course, you know, there are many animals in each diorama, or several animals in each diorama.
That's what I was getting at when I
yeah.
listed the stuffed
there are
animals.
Birds. There are, you know, rodents. There are things in the water, you know, there's all sorts of things. They just chose one to highlight and name. You would not see all of those things at once. It's kind of like a snapshot of a composite, you know, if you will. But they're done tastefully, like our senior curator of zoology and botany, Dr. Walter Mashaka, it's his exhibit. we had to watch because he wanted to sneak in some more, he's a herpetologist, some more salamanders and things. It's like, you've got to watch because it'll become too populated and it won't be believable. But Walter had so much fun. Now he wants to call things the snake diorama and the salamander diorama.
So, you know, it's a shame when there are species that you have to turn down. So there actually was a cut list, huh?
Well, there's a basic, you know, like it. There are too many animals in there. That's not going to work.
What are, when you talk about 40,000 children coming through the museum, what are the most popular animals? What animals in the dioramas are the children most attracted to or find most fascinating? Now, this would probably just be an observation.
Oh, yeah,
rather
it's anecdotal.
Than, you know, yeah.
But I do it. I see kids and anybody. Everybody loves the bison diorama. That's the largest diorama. It's the centerpiece. It's a nighttime, kind of like a midnight sky. You feel cold when you look at it because there's snow. It's like it takes up your whole view shed. And not only do I see people like it, people tell me that's their favorite, but I see it a lot on Instagram and Facebook when people visit the museum. They take pictures of it, and they enjoy that. I see kids looking at the fox. There are two fox dioramas next to each other. The foxes, if nothing else, they're just so cute. You know, they look like little pets. And I see, you know, people, the kids really gravitating toward them. The bears are very popular. You don't want to get any closer to a bear than
that's
that.
Right,
you
that's
know.
Right. One that's not going to be coming at you.
Right.
But, you know, I think one of the reasons for the bison, I actually, here at the station the other day when I was telling someone we were doing this today, mm-hmm. they mentioned, I didn't know Pennsylvania had bison.
Well, maybe 250 years
right.
ago. That
right.
scene is not a current depiction. It's like middle of the 1700s is what that's supposed to be of. But I think that's one of those situations, and I don't know for sure, but that the museum had access to a great bison specimen, you know, that was mounted 55 years ago, and they said, you know what, we need to have a bison diorama.
Well, Beth, one of the things I think that one of the characteristics of this that I think that many people have been interested in is the actual process to restore. I know you've actually produced a video, mm-hmm. and I think we have a link to it on our website, wytf.org. Mm-hmm. But many people have been fascinated by the process of this restoration. Explain how it happened.
Oh, it was just a major project, 3 years in the making, 5 years if you count when we first started talking about how we were going to go forward with it. We had grappled with, you know, what were the next steps, what do we need to do, and we found out that the American Museum of Natural History, which has incredible dioramas, had just finished a restoration project. And to make a long story short, we went up there. Museums are very giving with their information. Their art director for that project had just retired. We brought him down here to look at ours. He loved them, which is another indicator, I think, of the quality of ours. And Stephen Quinn, he's a world expert on dioramas, and he brought a team down here of folks that had worked at the American Museum of Natural History to work with our staff at the State Museum to restore these dioramas. We were careful during the time we only had half of it open at a time, closed at a time, so people could see the work going on through walls, you know, windows and walls. Now we have a small exhibit that our staff produced in-house to show people some of those processes, some of the things that went on during the project, seeing somebody vacuuming a deer in the, you know, the elaborate platforms that we had to build to get in the dioramas with the glass down, you know, taxidermy. We also have some original materials from when the dioramas were made, like the original molds for many of the leaves and plant material are on display. Those videos that you mentioned are interviews with different members of the team, some of our staff members and some of the restoration experts that came in, and they're talking about different aspects of the restoration. So it is fascinating because you don't see it's a kind of a once in a career time to get to be a part of that. And they, no leaf was unturned. I mean, it just
was. And that's not a cliche.
No, it's not. It really is. We have people on our staff that will be forever remembered for cleaning leaves, and did a fantastic job. But that was part of the fascination as well. But we went to, it's a huge project. We brought in great people. We use great staff because this is worth it. Again, going back to your original question, why do people love these? I mean, this is an exhibit that needs to stand the test of time, and so that restoration will ensure that.
I will say, now I'm sounding a little geeky or nerdy here, but as a Pennsylvanian, I'm always proud going to the State Museum and seeing what the state has to offer. And whether it's a child, whether it's an adult, no matter what age, you always can learn something. And I mean, just talking about the bison or the wolf that no longer in the woodlands of Pennsylvania, but many people probably don't even realize
Thank you, Scott. I'm glad to hear you say that, because that is our goal. Pennsylvanians need a great state museum. They need things that will really illuminate the great role that this state has in every walk of life, really. I mean, there's just so many fascinating things in Pennsylvania, from, you know, nation building to the industrial age. I mean, and all things in between. There's just so much to see. And we have several new things going on at the museum. We have a lot of programs happening to illuminate that. And also, we've got work to do. I mean, just keep coming back, because there'll be new things to see all the time.
Beth Eggers, Director of the State Museum of Pennsylvania. Beth, thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you, Scott. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, as you've heard all week, it is the 10th anniversary of Smart Talk. The show debuted on October 9th, 2008. But on tomorrow's program, we talk about the history of the program and what goes into making a Smart Talk. We had an event earlier this week where we discussed those things, and you'll hear that on tomorrow's show. The Harrisburg Book Festival begins today at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. And to tell us more about it today is Catherine Lawrence, owner of the Midtown Scholar. Catherine, good to see you again.
Oh, delighted to be here. And happy anniversary to you.
Thank you very much.
That's just such a great accomplishment. I still remember those early first months of shows, to be captivating our listeners' attention with your interesting delving into politics or health issues or economics, as it were.
Well, I have to say that books have always been a big part of it. Our audience, you know, we started by talking about like books to give for gifts at the holiday season. I think that was our very first show where we just were recommending books and, you know, reviewing books, that kind of thing. But it is one of our most popular shows, holiday season, maybe at the beginning of summer when people are getting a book for a vacation. But I always have listeners say, oh, when are you going to have Catherine Lawrence on and the others who participate? I'm reading a book or I'm looking for a book. So I think it's, you know, your appearances on Smart Talk have always been big contributions to the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm always delighted to come on and discuss books with you. So our book festival is happening this weekend.
Started already today, right?
Yes, it starts tonight. Our opening keynote is by Tayari Jones, who is an Oprah Book of the Year with her new novel, An American Marriage. It's a terrific book about a couple and the challenges they go through when the husband is wrongly imprisoned for something he did not do, and how will their marriage possibly be able to sustain when he's wrongly convicted of this crime and imprisoned. And she writes eloquently with a sort of multiple viewpoints in this, the story of this tragically challenged family from the sort of Atlanta to New York area.
So, yeah, I had, you probably are aware, I had Tayari Jones on Smart Talk a few weeks ago and did read the book, An American Marriage.
Right.
And I agree. I understand why Oprah would endorse it and make it part of the book club, and President Obama said it was one of his favorite books as well. Really a great read, and she actually speaks tonight, right?
Yes, she speaks at night. Tonight you can get tickets available at the door for the entry and book together, and then she'll be available for signing after the talk. That's at 7 o'clock tonight at the bookstore.
All right, so let's talk about the book festival. This is the 6th annual book festival. How'd it come about, and what are you trying to do with it every year?
Right, I think in some some ways, it gives ordinary readers and Central Pennsylvanians a chance to do the kinds of things that you and I get to do all the time. You get to interview authors. We're delighted to have you coming on Saturday
yes.
to be interviewing Liza Mundy, author of the WITF Pick Code Girls.
The October Pick of the Month Code Girls. And yeah, that's a great book too.
Yes. So we wanted to bring together novelists, historians, political figures, memoirists, poets, a great kind of literary conglomeration there. But the interesting special part of it is that ordinary readers and Central Pennsylvanians can come and ask questions of the authors at our talks. All except the first event tonight are free and open to the public, and you get to converse with authors all the time. But this is a chance for anyone to come and ask your questions and hear from the authors themselves what inspired them, why did they write, and what are they working on next. And the books that we've picked are often books that people in the area have been reading as their book club pick. So my summer book club read American Marriage as its pick in August, and I think that they're really good reads. And we worked hard to assemble a really diverse group of authors.
Who are some of the authors?
Yes.
I hate to interrupt, but who are some of the authors?
So our closing events on Sunday feature, as the closing keynote, Carol Anderson, who's a professor at Emory University and a Guggenheim Fellow Award winner, and she's written recently a book called White Rage on the unspoken truth of our racial divide from 1865 to the present. She's written on the history of NAACP in the World War II era and aftermath. And her most recent book is called One Person, No Vote: How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. But it's not an ordinary or dull history in any way. It really is bringing to life the characters of individual people and stories who have been engaged in the resistance of organizing and activism and court battles in our recent history, 2013 to the present, to be able to really exemplify those stories of people who are putting their beliefs into action in the public sphere. And I think that's what we have done with all of our different picks of authors to come. We've really picked people who are good storytellers, so you can come and hear them give their account of whether it's the co-girls at Liza Mundy, the voices she's recovered of the, you know, women in World War II, to the resistance workers that Carol Anderson is telling us about on Sunday.
Well, the co-girls, as you said, this is a New York Times bestseller,
right?
When I'm speaking with Liza Mundy in front of the audience Saturday night at Midtown Scholar, it's, you know, I love books as a history buff. I love books that tell stories of little known history.
Right.
And that, one of the things that's striking, I don't know if you've read the book or not, but one of the things that's striking about this book is that it was, these were women who were code breakers, Japanese and Germany in particular, but so few people knew about it because they were sworn to secrecy,
right.
And they did not tell anyone.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there were times where, you know, something would sneak out, but they were sworn to secrecy. They couldn't even tell their parents, their spouses, their children, anyone about this. So as a result, this has been lost to history.
Right.
And as you're reading the book, you realize what a major part these code breakers played, and they were mostly women, these code breakers played in the defeat of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan and the other Axis countries, that they played such a huge role, and we just don't know about it.
Right, and she's done such a miraculous work of recovering the voices of these older women, and as they still are here with us alive to tell their stories.
But
she's
the thing is, can
moment.
I interrupt for just a second? There are some of them that even today, they may be in their late 80s, 90s, are hesitant to tell the story because they were sworn to secrecy.
Right. Even their closest loved ones never hearing the story. So we hope at the book festival to bring and recover many of those voices of sort of behind the scenes stories that you might not hear or know about otherwise. Another event we have Sunday is a duo, David Litt, who is a former speechwriter for Barack Obama, and Becky Dory Stein, who was a stenographer in the Obama White House and actually for the first months of the Trump White House as well. And they will give us the behind-the-scenes story of, you know, voices in the action, in the midst of it, insider voices, but that we don't normally hear. So insiders, outsiders, recovering voices, they're great stories to be had all weekend long.
Blind date with a book?
Yes, right. Oh, then there are literary activities. We've got a scavenger hunt that Fear No Lit in Lancaster is sponsoring throughout our bookstore. We've got blind date with a book. If you like such and such book, then our staff has picked a certain one and wrapped in brown paper. Will you risk $5 to have a match up with it? I think you should. I've seen the books behind the scenes. They're good matches there.
So, Catherine, we only have a few seconds left, but information for those, because we know there will be people who will travel from outside of Harrisburg to Midtown.
Right. We have our own website for it, hbgbookfest.com. You can get the full schedule there, plan your visit, where to park, all those important things.
Catherine Lawrence is one of the owners of Midtown Scholar Bookstore. Always fun, Catherine.
Thanks
I look
so
forward
much.
To Saturday night, 6 o'clock with Liza Monday at Midtown Scholar. Thank you very much. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Coming up on tomorrow's show, kind of talking about the 10th anniversary, last 10 years of Smart Talk, and what goes into planning for the program. That's coming up on tomorrow's show.